Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Physical and political tremors in South America, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Brazil is shaken by an impeachment vote against the country's elected president.
This whole impeachment movement is being viewed by the left wing in this country as a coup attempt.
Meanwhile, damaged roads in Ecuador slow the response to a powerful earthquake there.
Foreign teams have had a hard time getting there, and there has been restriction on the roads to avoid people endangering themselves in order to reach their loved ones.
Also, he was born in Iran 110 years ago, but lives in Toronto now, and he has little patience for our reporters' questions.
This is not a proper question, even.
Not sure.
What kind of questions are these?
All that ahead, today on The World. It's Marathon Monday here in Boston. It's a day of celebration and reflection. We're going to hear what it's like 3 years after the Boston bombing. But first we go to Brazil, where the political crisis has hit a boiling point. Yesterday, the lower house of Congress voted to impeach the president, Dilma Rousseff. Will Carlos of our Global Post team is in the capital of Brasilia, and he talked to demonstrators at both pro and anti-impeachment rallies yesterday. Well, it sort of sounded like a party there when you hear the sound and watch the video. What was the atmosphere like as lawmakers voted to impeach Dilma Rousseff?
Well, it really depends what side of the literal fence you were on. The government had put a big fence up down the middle of the esplanade where all the protesters were. And I think, you know, fairly self-explanatory. On one side, the pro-impeachment side, it was a very excited atmosphere. A lot of people sort of playing drums, drinking beer and cheering with glee every time there was a vote against Dilma. And on the other side, with every progressive vote, people started to drift away until there weren't that many people left.
Now, this vote yesterday was a key step in Rousseff's impeachment, but it's not the final one. How likely does it seem that she will actually get booted out of office?
I think it's fair to say it's very likely at this point. The next hurdle she has to overcome is a vote of the Senate. Most people think that's going to happen very quickly and very easily. And then at that point, she has to step down for 180 days while the actual trial takes place. So I think it's fair to say that she's in a lot of trouble at this point.
Well, clarify for us what exactly Dilma Rousseff is getting impeached for, because as I read about it, it's not about being involved directly in corruption. So what is it?
Well, there's a legal side to that question, and then there's a political side to it. There's a strict legal side is that she's accused of financial irregularities in the run-up to the 2014 election. It should be noted that was hardly touched on at all in yesterday's vote. So this is a political thing. This is a lot of people who are upset with Dilma Rousseff that want her out. And indeed, if you talk to a lot of the pro-impeachment people, it's a lot bigger than that. A lot of the people who are pushing to get Dilma out, basically they want a whole clearing of the house. They want most of Brazil's political leaders kicked out. Here's Ivan Gunter. He's a 20-year-old from Belo Horizonte. And this is what he said.
Qualquer pessoa que tentar impedir a vontade do povo vai receber a resposta do povo.
So basically what he's saying is anybody who tries to impede the will of the people will receive the same response from the people and will be kicked out of the presidential palace and kicked out of the government. And that's a sentiment that I heard again and again and again from people, it should be said, on both sides of that fence.
And are there politicians or political platforms that are being pushed forward as a replacement?
So there are politicians that automatically take control. So the next guy in line is a guy called Michel Temer. He is, I think it's fair to say, a more sort of centrist, conservative character than Dilma. He's also, though, loathed by most Brazilians. And he's also possibly going to be impeached because he was involved in the same financial misdeeds that Dilma was involved in. So when he takes the reins of power, he's going to have to do a lot to convince the Brazilian public that he can start moving the country in the right direction. And frankly, that he's not just as corrupt as the rest of them.
Well, I'm just curious, have any of Dilma's opponents raised the thorny question of, oh, this democracy thing isn't really working out, we should try something else?
It's not so much Dilma's opponents, it's actually Dilma's supporters. This whole impeachment movement is being viewed by the left wing in this country as a coup attempt. And it should be said, it is going forward sort of reasonably calmly. We didn't see any riots yesterday. We didn't see any sort of really big protest. Things kind of just keep grinding forwards.
Brazil is South America's largest economy, and it's a huge world economy at this point. Are there likely to be repercussions from a Dilma impeachment around the world?
That's a tricky one. I mean, the BRICS are in big trouble right now. Brazil, Russia, India, China. Russia is falling apart. South Africa's president might be impeached. I mean, it's really sad times for these countries that were seen as these beacons of hope for the developing world. So I think there are repercussions. Things are really on a knife edge right now. They've got to start turning things around. And if they don't, then that could have repercussions elsewhere too.
And of course, the Rio Olympics, just 4 months out. Any concerns about that?
I think the concerns are one of confidence. So the longer this political drama draws out, the less likely people are to book their tickets to Brazil and to sort of say, hey, Brazil's where I want to spend my summer and I want to go check out the Olympics.
Will Carlos is in Brasilia today, reporting for our Global Post team. Thanks, Will.
Thank you.
It's also been a weekend bracketed by real live tremors in Japan and Ecuador. 2 days after Ecuador's magnitude 7.8 earthquake, the damage appears to be much worse than initially thought. At least 350 people are dead and thousands more injured. Coastal areas in northwest Ecuador are the worst affected. That includes resort towns and rural villages, where relief efforts have been slow in coming. Carolina Loza León is a journalist based in Quito. Carolina, did you feel the earthquake in Quito?
We did. It was quite strong. We're used to Quito because it's surrounded by volcanoes. It's usually used to 2 to 3 in the Richter scale earthquakes, very small scale. But we have never experienced nothing like this.
And the epicenter is about 150 miles away from you, isn't it, in northwest Ecuador?
Yes, it's in the between the Esmeraldas and Manabí province. Manabí has been the hardest hit. And I know towns such as Pedernales have areas that are covered in rubble. Manta, where I have family in that area, Manta is a very vibrant city. It's a hot spot in the last few years for retirees from the U.S., and it's in complete rubble now. So it's devastating images that we did not expect to see here in Ecuador.
I understand the Ecuadorian government underestimated the damage at first. Why was that?
It was hard to be able to get a grasp of all the damage that had been done. The earthquake happened at 7 at night. We started getting reports there was a communications breakdown. Many people around in some parts of town did not see any damage. Still, images started emerging of Manta and Guayaquil that we slowly started to realize the extent of the damage and the response it needed.
We're hearing that relief efforts are having trouble getting to some rural areas that were affected by the earthquake. Why is that?
Most of the rural areas are very impoverished and they lack access to roads in many parts. The roads also have been severely damaged. So it's been a slow response in still trying to reach areas.
Several countries have offered international assistance to Ecuador. Has any of that help been accepted and will it get there in time?
Most of the help has been accepted. I know Colombia and Mexico send their Red Cross teams. The United Nations Development Program has set up an account for donations from abroad. The thing is that most of these efforts have been channeled through the Ecuadorian government to avoid major influx of NGOs and avoid wasted relief efforts. There's rumors on local media that Los Topos, which is a group from Mexico, search and rescue, very well known, were rejected from coming here because of where their funding comes from. That's still to be confirmed, and no official response has been issued, but it was an outpour of anger in social media from Ecuadorians saying that we're in no position to reject any sort of aid.
Carolina, you've been speaking with some victims of the earthquake. From their point of view, is the aid getting to them soon enough?
I just recently spoke to someone whose family is in Pedernales, and they said that the aid is not getting there as fast. You know, you have many bureaucratic hurdles. In order to get there, it's also another hurdle. So they have been complaining about shelter, where they're going to sleep for the night, and people have been saying that they can hear still people trapped in the rubble screaming for help.
Is social media playing any role in this disaster?
Yes, the government has been very controlling regarding how information is provided when it comes to natural disasters. But what people complained on social media on Saturday night was that there was no official figure on the death toll. So a lot of them took on social media to communicate. There's also hashtags. One is called Encontrados S, which is for people that have been found, and the other one is Desaparecidos, which is for people that went missing. So social media is playing a key role.
Reporter Carolina Loza León has been speaking to us from Quito. Thanks so much, Carolina.
Thank you.
We're going to go now to Japan and hear one man's story about experiencing the tremors there. Sean Michael Wilson is a Scottish comic book writer living in Kumamoto, where a major earthquake struck on Thursday. It was followed by a series of about 150 aftershocks that rattled the area. Sean says after that, people thought it was all over and they were safe. Then came the second quake.
It was Friday night to Saturday morning, 1:30 on Saturday morning. And I just was getting ready to go to bed. And then the second one, which was much stronger, hit us. And everyone was outside in a state of shock. You couldn't believe it. Another much, much stronger and more destructive quake had come again.
From that, did you go right to the shelter?
We all went down to the shelter with pretty much everyone in the area, from young students to old grandmothers and kids, filed in. We were in the sports ground outside. And what we did was we pushed the fences over, and we laid on the fences and we kind of made makeshift beds. And it was a little bit cold, of course. But there was a kind of a pleasant, to use an analogy from British history, a Dunkirk spirit, the spirit of the Blitz, if you know what I mean by that, that everybody felt we're in it together. And because this area is a university area, there's a lot of non-Japanese. There's Chinese, Indonesians, a few Americans, a few Europeans. People were helping each other and being nice to each other, laying out blankets and saying, do you have water? It was a very heartwarming thing.
Sean, what does the shelter provide that your home doesn't in situations like this?
First of all, warmth, because some people have had their electricity cut off. Some people have had the water cut off. Well, not some, a lot. 200,000 are without water still now. And so you get basic food and shelter. But then there's a certain sense of camaraderie. That's one thing that the Japanese do very well, that they're good and calm in a crisis and very well organized.
How many people were at that shelter that you were staying at?
There's about 300. And I went there again today, a few hours ago, to get some food, because there's a great shortage of food here now, and the Japanese Self-Defense Force, they delivered it to us. So we have a real shortage of food here, and the gas is not working. You can't take a shower, you can't wash. It's getting a little bit cold today. What I sense and what I personally feel now is a sense of physical and mental exhaustion of 4 days of having to deal with this.
In the shelter, are people still kind of reeling and upset from these earthquakes, or what is the mood in there?
No, I think today and yesterday, people are starting to relax. When I was walking back across the sports ground, there was 4 or 5 Japanese teenagers playing football, and they started to speak to me in their broken English and laughing. So I feel as if maybe people will start to get over it.
Are you back home now in your home?
Yes, I just came back today. And unfortunately, there was quite a large quake about an hour ago. So there may be another quake while we're having this conversation. So I'm starting to have second doubts as to whether I should stay here or not. If another large quake does come, I will go back over to the shelter, which is luckily only a few minutes away because I live right next to the university area.
Sean Michael Wilson is a comic book writer living in Kumamoto, Japan, where several earthquakes have forced residents to seek shelter in gymnasiums and hotels. Thanks so much, Sean. I wish you well.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The World. Where are you from? That question has been a conversation starter for millennia. Take the case of the Etruscans. They arrived in what is now Tuscany thousands of years ago, and they spoke a language completely unrelated to those spoken throughout the region. Recently, archaeologists discovered an ancient slab of sandstone that appeared to be inscribed with Etruscan, perhaps providing a new clue to a very old mystery. Where did the Etruscans come from? The World's Alina Simone has more.
For hundreds of years, scholars have debated the origin of the Etruscans, a powerful clan with an alien tongue and strange customs, who emerged in what is now central Italy, sometime around the 6th century BC. But no one is more obsessed with the Etruscans than the Italians themselves, and I'm not just talking history nerds.
I think that 90% of taxi drivers can tell you something about Etruscans.
This is Francesco Cini, a resident of Florence who recently managed the major excavation of an Etruscan well.
I am personally fascinated by Etruscans. There's a lot of people who is fascinated about Etruscans because it's a very charming ancient population.
But there were hundreds of groups migrating around Europe at the same time, and the Etruscan language has been dead for more than a millennium. So why should we care about these guys?
The Etruscans are basically the teachers of the Romans.
Yaroslav Gorbachev is a linguistics professor at the University of Chicago. The Etruscans were the first kings of Rome, he explains, and were hugely influential on the Romans. They passed along elements of Greek civilization, like the invention of alphabetic writing, and essentially helped plant the seeds of Western culture.
A lot of what the Romans did, a lot of their beliefs, came from the Etruscans. So they are the teachers of our teachers, and it's just a fascinating issue. Where did the teachers of our teachers come from?
Their language may be dead, but people are still using Etruscan words today. Words like people. And linguistics is just one tool scholars are using to figure out whether the ancient historian Herodotus may have been right about how the Etruscans first reached Italy. According to Herodotus, the story goes something like this. Around 800 BC, there was a famine in Lydia, what is now western Turkey. Eventually, the king, quote, divided the people into two groups and made them draw lots, so that the one group should remain and the other leave the country. It's unclear which group this scenario actually favored, but according to Herodotus, the castaways eventually ended up in Italy.
Now, Herodotus has multiple stories that sound fishy, and so some people, you know, outright dismissed Herodotus' story. And other people who have studied the Etruscans were fascinated by this and kind of semi-convinced that it might be true.
Over the past 15 years, linguists have uncovered some tantalizing clues. Similarities between Etruscan and certain languages of Bronze Age Western Turkey are uncanny. There are certain words that, Gorbachev says, could only have been borrowed from the Lydians and their neighbors, the Luvians. For example, the Etruscan word for wine,
which is matu, looks precisely like the Luvian word for wine, which is matu with a double T.
And the Etruscans shared some unique customs with the Lydians and Luvians as well, like the practice of haruspicy,
which is a form of divination from inspection of, well, basically entrails, mostly, usually liver, of sacrificial animals, and you kind of glean the will of the gods by inspecting the liver of sacrificed animals.
Then in 2007, Italian geneticist Alberto Piazza found what seemed to be the smoking gun, studying paternally inherited DNA from people living in three formerly Etruscan communities. Piazza discovered a residual genetic link to, you guessed it, Turkey. And a different study found that a local breed of cattle also shared a genetic link with Turkey. Anthony Tuck, a professor of archaeology at UMass Amherst, who has studied Etruscan civilization for 27 years, was there in the ancient Etruscan town of Bescabada the day news of Piazza's DNA discovery broke.
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing.
Tuck saw for himself how the region's immigrants reacted to the finding.
The Serbs and the Kosovars and the North Africans who live in Vescovado were clapping and honking horns that all of a sudden, like the Tuscans, who always had a kind of a scratchy relationship to these immigrants, then all of a sudden they were the immigrants.
But unlike these recent arrivals, Tuck is not convinced the Etruscans really were from Turkey.
As an archaeologist, you know, I look at and think about material culture. And, you know, the architecture of the Etruscans, the language of the Etruscans, the virtually every aspect of the physical and material behavior of the Etruscans doesn't look anything like that which we see in Lydia.
He doesn't see any hard proof that the Etruscans weren't simply members of an ancient indigenous culture. That's the problem with the Etruscan mystery. Could, might, we just don't know. What few clues remain can be interpreted in many different ways. Here you're listening to a modern interpretation of how Etruscan music might have sounded, based on the look of their instruments. The Eastern words and customs found among the Etruscans, they could easily have been borrowed. Ideas, religions, and catchphrases circulated in ancient times just as they do today. What explains that DNA overlap? Well, Turkish women could have circulated too, sold or bartered in ancient chattel markets. And in 2013, another study conducted with the same groups only using maternally inherited DNA showed no genetic link to Turkey. Results that back the theory of another ancient historian, Dionysus of Halicarnassus, who claimed the Etruscans were just always there. Maybe the real debate isn't between Herodotus and Halicarnassus, but whether it really matters.
What makes someone Etruscan? Is it purely a linguistic question? We don't really do ourselves a whole lot of favors when we kind of paint with big, broad strokes and talk about like mysterious cultures and whatnot. And the culture is simply a much more complex entity than just the question of who you're, you know, who 30, 40 generations back contributed to your genetic identity.
Okay, sure. Etruscan culture can't just be explained with a blood test. But there's still this desire to understand exactly how they came to be in Italy, a desire to separate historical fact from fiction, which continues to motivate scholars like Yaroslav Gorbachev.
So if you take these pieces of evidence, the textual, the linguistic, the genetic, the archaeological, and cultural slash material, in isolation, then, you know, some of the pieces look inconclusive, some of them look iffy, but if you take them all together, and they all seem to point east, I am personally convinced that Herodotus was for once right.
A lot of native Italians are too, like Francesco.
I would be excited to know that I have some Turkish DNA in my blood, just to know that it's a part of my story, because it's interesting.
It's kind of like learning you have a drop of Viking blood, the new, my great-great-grandmother was Native American. Maybe the Etruscans really were the original Italians. But what kind of story is that? For The World, this is Alina Simone.
To hear more stories about language, subscribe to our podcast, The World in Words. Get it at iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. And this is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, how security has changed at the Boston Marathon since the bombings 3 years ago. Plus, what it's like to run the Pyongyang Marathon in North Korea.
We really got to see everyday North Koreans coming out, enjoying a show in the same way that the residents of Boston would for their marathon.
Those stories ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. An exciting day here in Boston.
Ethiopia's Lemmy Haile wins the 2016 Boston Marathon with a big smile, and he skips at the end of that victory.
Yep, the 21-year-old Ethiopian runner Lemmy Haile won the men's race in 2 hours, 12 minutes, and 45 seconds. That sound courtesy of WBZ-TV here in Boston. It's been a good year for Ethiopian runners. Atsede Besa, also Ethiopian, won the women's race, coming in at 2 hours, 29 minutes, 19 seconds. I spoke with my WGBH colleague Craig Lamolt, who spent the day at the finish line. He says security was tight after the 2013 Boston bombings.
Some of the people that I spoke to said they were a little nervous about coming to the finish line given what happened with the bombing here several years ago, but that once they went through that kind of a check, they felt pretty secure and they felt pretty safe and they were happy to be here and they're just having a good time.
Craig, I know several survivors of the 2013 bombings were in the race this year. You spoke with a wheelchair participant who lost his legs in the bombings. What did he have to say today?
I was there as Mark Fucaril got over the finish line. He lost his leg in the original bombing, and he was just in a great mood. He was horsing around, shaking hands with people. He just talked about the amazing support that he received along the route, and he said he actually rode with a wounded warrior the whole way. He just really had a blast.
Amazing. Speaking of wheelchair racers, I know you got to interview the winner of this year's women's wheelchair race, Tatiana McFadden. This is her fourth year winning the wheelchair women's division at Boston Marathon. She's got quite a backstory. Tell us a bit about her.
It is pretty remarkable. She was born with spina bifida, and she was paralyzed from the waist down, and she spent the first 6 years of her life in a Russian orphanage. She learned to walk on her hands. And then she wound up being adopted by the Commissioner of Disabilities for the U.S. Department of Health, who was visiting the orphanage, who just felt like she had a real connection with her and brought her home. And now here she is winning her fourth Boston Marathon on a wheelchair race. And she just seemed to be thrilled to have won yet again. She said it was a great day out there. It was pretty warm, actually, throughout the race. But she had a really good time and a remarkable showing here once again at the Boston Marathon.
I read she wins these races all over the country.
Yeah, she's really a top-notch athlete, and there's very few other women who, or really anybody, who have won four Boston Marathons. She's in very small company there and seemed to be pretty excited about it.
Craig, you've covered both the marathons since the Boston bombing in 2013. When you talked with runners today, is 2013 still on their minds?
You know, it's always in the back of their mind, I think, but today is not really about that. I think it's really something that they're never going to forget here in Boston. No one's going to forget it. Certainly when you're at the finish line or you're a runner and competing in the race, it's always there. But there's just so much joy here and actually a lot of pain of just being a runner, I think, too, that there's a lot of other things to focus on. And people are really here to appreciate the athleticism of the runners, to support family members and friends and others and strangers who have done this pretty remarkable thing. And I think that that's first in their minds. They don't forget what happened, but this is a fun day in Boston.
WGBH's Craig LaMolt down at the finish line of the Boston Marathon on Boylston Street. Thanks, Craig.
You're welcome.
A fun day in Boston, but security is definitely part of the mix. Juliet Kayyem is a former undersecretary for Homeland Security. She's author of the new book, Security Mom, An Unclassified Guide to Protecting Our Homeland and Your Home. And she told me there's a lot of surveillance that you see on the marathon route this year, and some you don't.
There's aerial surveillance through drones. There are typically issues related to chemical, biological identification. So, you know, in terms of if there's anything in the air, there are surveillance cameras on site at various places. Because what people have to remember is that it's not 26.2 miles that have to be secured. It's 52.4. In this city, the marathon is on both sides of the street. And so that's just a lot of essentially runway that you have to protect.
One thing I'm really curious about is in this year's Boston Marathon course, there was some technology that was used to actually take baseline readings of radiation from
yes.
Hopkinton to Boston. How's that work?
It's being done through helicopters and aerial testing. It reinforces what's being done on the ground. Let me just calm people down. There's just no specific credible threat for, you know, a dirty bomb or anything of that magnitude. But aerial surveillance of baseline activity, whether it's radiological or otherwise, is not the best way to do it. And there's actually on-ground assets that have always been at the marathon through the National Guard that are monitoring it as well.
Now, it's been 3 years since the Boston bombing, and I sort of imagine that marathon planners for this year may have thought they could relax a bit. But even just since last year's marathon, there have been major attacks in Paris, San Bernardino, and Brussels. What does that say about the ability to ever sort of let up or relax or ever really fully protect these giant public events?
So you're not going to ever fully protect major events or all soft targets, whether it was in Paris with a bar or a concert hall or even a marathon. And that's sort of the theme of my book and the way that I want people to understand safety and security in this day and age. We are too porous and open of a country, let alone a city that is embracing, you know, tens of thousands of runners and spectators today to get the vulnerabilities to zero. What we do know how to do well is during events, high profile events, what we call mega events in security planning, we do know how to secure places that might be vulnerable, in particular the finish line for the Boston Marathon. In terms of this letting up, I think the Boston Marathon will have a strong security presence for the foreseeable future. There'll be a time when the bombings are not at the forefront of everyone's sort of narrative of the Boston Marathon. We see it, look, in just a few months, we're having the 15th anniversary of September 11th. And, you know, it's just not at the forefront of our narrative anymore.
Juliette, you're a security expert. You worked in government at a time where there were all sorts of disasters, from the BP oil spill to the Christmas underwear bomber. You're also a parent. Do you honestly think your family is significantly less safe now than it was a decade ago?
The notion that there's some moment in which we're safe and there's some white flag hanging over the United States saying, oh, we're all clear now, is just, I think it's sort of a delusional way to think about the risks we have as a nation. I haven't even talked about gun issues, right, which is one of the major risks here. So I talk about our safety and security in terms of, are we safer and have we minimized the risk? I think that is true. Though the risk has changed, the kind of terrorism risk that we have today is the kind we saw at the Boston Marathon. No safety and security apparatus is going to stop every guy or brothers that are going to radicalize and have access to guns or weaponry and go to some soft or semi-soft target as the marathon was 3 years ago. And I think we do have to brace ourselves for that and also invest in the response and preparedness apparatus that got us Boston strong.
It was interesting to read in your book another cliche that you sort of disabuse us of, which is the keep calm and carry on campaign poster from World War II in Britain. As you point out, the whole thing never really happened.
Yeah. And this is the poster that has sort of made its way, and there's all variations of, you know, of it, like keep calm and call me maybe and things like that. And it actually turns out that it was part of a very aggressive World War II public education campaign that Churchill never allowed to happen. The posters were made, and Churchill said he didn't want this slogan to go out. They reemerged in 2005 when a bookstore owner was going through some old boxes, and he sees these posters and he absolutely loved them. He put them up. Some people wanted to buy them, and then eventually they went. They were a global phenomenon. And
what didn't Churchill like about it?
Because it was too passive. Because resiliency is actually active. It is actually investments, planning, training, preparedness. It's not the stiff upper lip. And he knew that for his citizens who were under a true existential threat. He knew the men had to stay in London and keep the engines of commerce going. He knew women had to go to work. They had to say goodbye to their children who were sent out to the countryside. Resiliency is not sitting back in your chair and saying, well, what will be, will be. And I think people should remember that.
Juliette Kayyem is a former Undersecretary for Homeland Security. She's the author of a new book, Security Mom, An Unclassified Guide to Protecting Our Homeland and Your Home. Thanks, Juliette.
Thank you.
Back in February, my colleagues Marco Werman and Matthew Bell spent a week in Iran reporting on life there after the nuclear deal. Recently, Matthew went to Toronto, which has a sizable population of Iranian expats, and he talked to people there about their hopes for the future of their home country. But one of his interviews turned out a little more challenging than Matthew expected.
Mohammed Moyadine was introduced to me as the oldest man in Canada. I'm not sure if that's technically true. In any case, Moyadine offered this caveat when we sat down on his living room couch in North Toronto to chat.
You know, I am 110 years old. I have forgotten many things. I have forgotten language, English, French, Turkey.
Moyadine was born in the mountains of central Iran in the city of Tafresh in 1906. Theodore Roosevelt was in the White House at the time. Iran was going through a constitutional revolution, and the British would soon start drilling for Persian oil. But the question I really wanted to ask Moyadine was not about the past. With all his experience and perspective, I wanted to know what he thinks about Iran's future. His answer sort of put me in my place.
I cannot say anything. Iran, I don't know what is its situation now. I don't know.
What if I ask you, what is your hope for Iran in the future? That's Samira Moyadin, his granddaughter.
Because he hasn't been there for so long.
Mm. He says, I cannot tell you what I think should happen.
It's
an absurd question. this question has no answer.
After Moyadin's family stopped laughing, I asked him about a picture on the wall taken just before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. It shows Moyadin in his military dress uniform. He was a general, shaking hands with the last Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. Moyadin said he didn't remember much about that day or his army days, broadly speaking, but he did recall one story. Moyadin said he reported two of his military superiors for stealing and corruption. They thought they could do whatever they wanted, he said. The men were arrested and put in prison. One of them, an opium addict, went into withdrawal and died 10 days later. The other committed suicide. Moyadin said he did the right thing by turning them in. But that uniform of his put him in grave danger. Supporters of the 1979 revolution began rounding up military officers and executing them. Moyadin and his wife followed their children, who had started to leave for Canada. That was nearly 4 decades ago. What was the sweetest thing, or maybe the thing that you missed the most after you left Iran?
I miss everything about the country, particularly its people.
Is there anything you miss most? Maybe the food?
People are asking me what foods I want or whatever. I'm beyond that at this point. Food is just fuel for me. This is not a proper question even. What kind of questions are these?
At this point, I switched gears and I asked Moyadin about the secrets of living a good, long life. He continued to put me in my place. Stop eating so much meat, he said. Eat stuff that grows out of the ground and on trees. Exercise. And for goodness sake, he said, get to work reproducing.
Chara.
Why do you only have 2 children? What's Chara. The matter with you?
That's a good question. When I protested that children are a lot of work, Moyadin told me to discipline them. But his wife, Ashraf, begged to differ. She just turned 100. The couple has 8 children, 20 grandkids, and 10 great-grandchildren. Number 11 is on the way. Ashraf Moyadin's advice was, don't worry about having more kids. They are hard work. As for my question about the future of Iran, she had a lot more to say than her husband. I hope for peace in Iran, Ashraf Moyadin said. We have all been waiting for the day when we could go back and live happily there. Unfortunately, she added, the clerics who rule the country now have made that impossible. Ashraf, who's a former school principal, said she's never really fallen in love with Canada. Nonetheless, the family has been successful. 5 of my sons are engineers, she said. 1 daughter is a nurse, 1 a dental hygienist, and 1's an accountant. This year, Ashraf and Mohammed will celebrate their 80th wedding anniversary. For the World, Matthew Bell, Toronto.
He gave Matthew a hard time, but he doesn't look that fierce. We have a photo of 110-year-old Mohammed Moyadin and his 100-year-old wife, Ashraf, at PRI.org. An experiment on the London Underground, coming up on The World. One more marathon story for you today. This one took place in Pyongyang earlier this month. Apparently, the North Korean government hosts a marathon in the capital every year. And this year, Beijing-based journalist Alec Ash wanted to find out what it's all about.
By running this marathon, you get to see more of the city of Pyongyang at a more leisurely pace at 10 kilometers an hour.
So he signed up.
So the race begins in the Mayday Stadium, which is the largest stadium in the world, and it's where they hold their mass games every year. And then we do four laps for the full marathon around the city, past these Stalinist monuments, the Friendship Tower, the Arch of Triumph, bronze statues of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il raising their arms, before it finally takes us home with a victory lap around that stadium while about 100,000 North Koreans look and cheer on.
Of course, it's Marathon Day here in Boston, and it's a big tradition for people to stand along the route and cheer the runners on. Did you experience that in Pyongyang as well?
I sure did, and that was what I enjoyed most about the experience. Those glimpses into the everyday lives of North Koreans around me. So along the streets we were running through, they were lined by kids who were sucking on sweets, blowing bubble gum, getting excited, giving high fives to the runners. There were grannies who were waving at us, giving us the thumbs up. We saw residents hanging out their laundry or waving from their balconies, as well as passing by the occasional army squadron doing their drills or cheerleaders doing a routine looking rather miserable.
Were there any do's and don'ts in terms of taking part in this marathon? You know, taking photos or talking to locals, anything like that?
There sure were. Photos were a sore point. We were instructed not to take any photos of construction sites because apparently those are run by the military. We were also told not to take any photos on the race itself, but that was pretty roundly ignored. Whereas the tour itself was very regimented, the marathon felt more like organized chaos, and everyone was taking their iPhones out and taking photos of kids by the wayside. Another restriction we were given was that the kit we were wearing on the run shouldn't display any large logos or any flags. It would be very embarrassing for them if there was a large American flag or other national flag on one of the runners. And the most worrying restriction for me was that there was a four-hour cut-off for the marathon itself. And if you didn't complete a marathon, 42 kilometres in 4 hours, you wouldn't get to finish. And for an amateur runner like myself, that was a bit of a challenge.
But you made it.
I just made it a little over 4 hours, and I was one of the last people to get into the stadium before they closed the gates.
What do you think this marathon represents for the North Korean government?
I think it represents a lot. It's a symbol of this rather paradoxical country, which is both very much shuttering in from the world and also trying to show off to the rest of the world and trying to show the world that it can welcome foreigners in and it can put on such a big show and such an international event. Also, sporting achievement has always been hugely important to the North Korean people. They're big football fans, soccer that is, and gymnastics is very important to them as well. So for them to run this marathon and put on this marathon is, as my guide told me, a symbol of their revolutionary spirit.
Alec Ash is a journalist in Beijing. He ran the Pyongyang Marathon earlier this month. Thanks, Alec.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Finally today, there are rules of conduct in any city. In London, there's one that has to do with the subway escalators. You stand on the right and walk on the left. But that changed this morning at one stop on the London Underground, and the world's Bradley Campbell was there to see it.
Call it tube etiquette. Now, the most important part of this is the escalator. You stand on the right and you walk on the left. Should you veer from this, you'll feel the cold wrath of London. That said, no one really knows where this practice came from.
I have no idea, and as you can hear from my accent, I'm from Scotland, and I remember when I first moved down to London, and I actually made the mistake of standing on the left, and you soon learn from the commuters coming behind you that you're doing something wrong, and you just all learn to do that. That's the unspoken rule, if you like.
Peter McNaught is now in charge of several main tube lines for London Underground, and it's an important gig. Up to 4 million people use the system each day. And it's one particular stop that he noticed a problem. Holborn Station. During the morning rush hour, it turns into an underground traffic jam. And it's all due to three escalators carrying people up to the surface.
What you find is the majority of customers do not want to walk up a very long escalator. And they tend to congregate at the bottom to wait to stand on the right-hand side.
A line forms, then a group, then a wall of people backing up all the way to the platform. but a study at Greenwich University showed there is a possible solution. The congestion would ease if everyone stood on both sides of the escalator. But the problem, no one wants to stand on both sides, or so they say. And that's because the London Underground did a trial last year. It lasted just 3 weeks, but it got good results. It showed that standing on both sides moved 30% more people per hour. Again, this only works for particular stations, ones with very long escalators and a high number of people trying to use them, places like Holborn Station. Now, based on the successful trial, London Underground made the decision to expand it. This time, they're going to try it for 6 months. And of the three escalators going up, two will be standing only. A third will be for walkers.
I think the first peak will be people getting used to doing it. It'll be quite difficult initially, and I think by the end of the week we'll be cooking on gas.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're asking to stand on both sides of the escalator, please.
We walk like cattle, slowly plodding toward the escalators. I step onto the right side and look down. There are four sets of footprints painted onto each step of the escalator, a marker that reminds both sides to stay put. We do, but a woman standing on the left side looks terribly uncomfortable.
Is this weird to stand on both sides?
Yeah, it's really weird.
What do you think about it?
It's not natural. It goes against the laws of London.
It said that it moves more people, but does it feel?
I can see it would, but I think because this is really long, so a lot of people don't want to walk off. It makes sense it would move more people, but it's just so confusing.
Do you feel awkward being on the left side and standing?
You're wrong, yeah. It feels really weird.
Like kind of like you're breaking the law?
Yeah.
Oh, we're almost there. We're almost there.
Oh, thank God. It's going to end soon.
At the top of the escalator, you can see the early results. The lines to the stand-only escalators moved people consistently and calmly. But the other escalator did not. It was supposed to be the walk-only escalator, but people reverted to the old ways. Stand on the right, walk on the left. And just like it always does at Holborn, a line formed at the bottom. For the world, Bradley Campbell, Inside the London Underground.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.